Okay, the title Son of Man was also the reference to Christ being married, but also his ties with the throne of David, but has the original definition of the Messiah to be the spiritual savior of mankind.
Well, it's just this, that number one, the title for like Ezekiel is Son of Man, not the Son of Man.
Right.
There's not a definite article there where Jesus called himself the Son of Man. So that's one clear distinction. He's claiming to be unique in that sense.
Right.
The other point of other point of distinction there is that he's not denying that he's going to be a political redeemer of Israel. He's not denying that he's going to conquer Israel's enemies. But the problem is the extra baggage that the Jews had added. They were actually, by doing that, they were overemphasizing a future aspect and ignoring the present aspect. And in other words, it wasn't as bad as what they added to the concept of Messiah was. What was even worse was what they took from the concept of Messiah.
Judge now, save later, rather than save now than judge later.
Yeah, they acted like, they acted like, you know, they really weren't in need of salvation, spiritual salvation.
Kind of true,
they just needed
off.
Political deliverance, and there were to the two Messiah theory, a suffering Messiah, in rabbinical oral tradition of the rabbis, Messiah ben Joseph, the suffering Messiah, and Messiah ben David, the reigning glorious Messiah. The other complexities that they had in the book of Hebrews might even be addressing this in the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Qumran community. They said, well, the Messiah is a priest in the order of Melchizedek, but he's got to be from the line of Judah in order to be a king. So maybe there's two Messiahs. A kingly Messiah from the line of Judah, from the tribe of Judah, and a priestly Messiah from the line of Levi, the tribe of Levi. And so the author of Hebrews is arguing, no, Jesus, you've got he's the king from the line of the tribe of Judah, but his priesthood is not from the Aaronic Levitical priesthood, it's from the Melchizedekian. He doesn't need to trace his genealogy. Melchizedek had no genealogy listed in the Bible. So the fact that the Bible records him as a priest of God and doesn't record his genealogy meant that genealogy was irrelevant to the Melchizedekian priesthood.
That's a cool story about Melchizedek. There is an example of somebody, because all he called God was Most High, Most High God. And Abraham, man, was like, whoa, you believe in the Most High God?
Yeah.
I have a dude, but his name's Yahweh, but
yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's definitely an anthropology. The anthropological studies are starting to bear this out. We used to think whenever anthropologists came across primitive tribes, they would be polytheistic or at least animistic. Okay, either believe in many gods or believe that all nature was alive. Okay. So they assume, well, they're the most primitive people on earth, these primitive tribes. Therefore, this is the oldest religion was animism. You know, first man was afraid of nature, so he started to see nature as alive, and trees and plants as living things, as like spirit entities. And then he eventually deified them so that he could try to offer sacrifices to them and pray to them and stuff like that. And that was the first religion of man. Well, now that they've broken down the language barrier and communicated with these primitive tribes, and they openly say, no, there's one creator God who made the lesser gods, but we don't remember his name, and we forgot how to worship him. So in the meantime, we offer animal sacrifices to appease the lesser gods because they're very nasty. And so from a Christian standpoint, what it's saying is they're worshiping demons because they forgot how to worship the one true God. And so basically through anthropological studies, the the leading theory right now is that the original religion was worship of one God and animal sacrifice as the proper worship of him. Well, all you got to do is go to Genesis chapter 4 and look at Abel's sacrifice, and there it is. So, but mankind originally knew God as Elohim, the mighty creator God.
Which that name itself is kind of an oxymoron. It's plural yet singular.
Yeah, it's plural. It's three or more, because it's not El singular or Elah dual. So it's plural, but when it's used of the true God, it will be joined with the singular form of the verb, like bara for create.
Right.
So
it's a third person singular.
So you could translate Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, one God of three or more created the heavens and the earth.
Or the Shema itself. Elohim is the hero, Israel, the Lord, our God, Lord is one. Elohim is there, what, two or three times?
Yeah.
Yahweh. It's like,
But ancient man knew of God as this great Elohim, the creator God, but then God revealed himself to the nation of Israel as Yahweh, the I Am Who I Am, the eternal God who is in covenant with the nation of Israel. So it was like you had Elohim, the creator God, and people knew from Adam and Eve. Could have been from oral tradition, could have been from God's revelation of himself in nature, could have been clear enough for all we know, but they knew that this great creator God exists, and that man stands fallen before him, and so there must be a blood sacrifice to appease him. And so I believe that the first form of the gospel, I agree with C.S. Lewis, Genesis 3:15, that from the seed of the woman would come who would crush the head of the serpent while the serpent bruised his heel, that ancient man was looking for a man who would be born of a woman. And keep in mind, the seed of the woman is never mentioned anywhere else in the scriptures. The seed literally means sperm. So it's always the seed of Abraham. It's always the seed of a male. Yet the seed of a woman is almost implying, you know,
just her.
Yeah, just her. There isn't a need for the seed of a male here. Okay, and so it's kind of a virgin birth is implied there.
Yeah.
But whatever the case. So ancient man knew that someday God would send the Redeemer, but until then, we'll go through these animal sacrifices before the one true God. Now, once mankind perverted God's revelation in nature and perverted that message coming from the garden, then God said, well, every nation's got their own false god. Let me take one polytheist, one pagan named Abraham, reveal myself to him so that he becomes a true believer, and then I will reveal myself to him and his people, and I will be the God of Israel. So that once mankind started inventing all these false gods and worshiping demons, God said, I am going to enter the contest for the souls of men. And so now the God of Israel has thrown his hat into the ring. And we'll compete with these other gods, and when the smoke clears, only the God of Israel will be left standing. So, yeah, so, now when you put Melchizedek in this picture, this guy still under quite possibly natural revelation, or it could have been special revelation, supernatural revelation, for all we know, a Christophany. Christ could have walked with him, a pre-incarnate Christ, for
like
all we know. Yeah, and, but whatever the case, this guy had so much insight into God that Abraham tithed to him.
He might have reached the old cattle.
So here Abraham, the first Israelite, and God is the God of Israel, his ministry was second to Melchizedek, so he died to him, and so that's why the author of Hebrews is saying, you know, Jesus is a priest in the order of Melchizedek, which is a higher priesthood than the Levitical priesthood, and you don't, the Melchizedekian priesthood, and the priest does his job, doesn't need to pass on his priesthood to others.
Like the Mormon. What's the Greek word? Aparabaton? No other?
Pass on. Well, that's neat. I didn't even.
No, yeah. It doesn't go along with.
That's where we get a word for a
baton.
Yeah, exactly.
I used to run relays.
A para means to not give the baton. So Christ is holding it, but no, this is passing. Yeah. Like the Mormons run around. Yeah, I'm in the order of Melchizedek, and then go on.
Participle from Daniel.
Which is Greek.
That's really neat.
Mark and I were battling the Mormons. We looked at what the heck is Melchizedek? What are they doing that? And there was a bunch of people, oh, cool, a par baton. Hey, you don't have no priesthood. Christ didn't pass on.
And it also argues for the.
He's really good with the Greek, of course.
That's all the book of Hebrews there, the fact that the priests are still standing, still working. It's also a good argument that the Hebrews had to be written before 70 A.D. Because why would a guy arguing against his opponents, trying to convince his opponents, and tell them the priests are still standing and offering sacrifices when they know the temple's been demolished?
Right.
You know, so, what do they call it? It's something like the official title that historians have now, called something like enemy attestation. In one sense, it's if your enemy admits to something, then it's got to be accurate because he's not biased towards your view. So, like when the Jewish Talmud, when they said that Jesus was a sorcerer. Well, they're admitting that there was some supernatural aspect about Jesus. It couldn't be explained in naturalistic terms. But there's also, it's like a two-edged sword, because it's also, when a guy is arguing a case, it's highly unlikely that he's going to lie about something that could easily be refuted by his opponents. When he's trying to convince his opponent of something, you know, that'd be like me arguing with an atheist and saying, look, the Bible is obviously the Word of God and obviously true, because all you have to do is go to Turkey right now and you will find in Turkey the Garden of Eden. And the cherubim with fiery swords are still guarding it to this day. Well, the atheist is either going to go to Turkey, or he's going to call up people in Turkey and ask them to check it out for him. And so, basically, no intelligent person who's trying to win an argument make up a story that would be so easy for his opponent to refute that, basically you're not going to use something that's easier to refute than your view itself. And so, that works towards the strength. And Paul arguing for the resurrection, listing the post-resurrection appearances of Christ is another case of that. Jude in Jude 3, where he says, that he wrote the letter to contend that they should contend earnestly for the faith once for all delivered to the saints. So Jude was in the business of defending the faith. Apollos, look at Apollos in Acts 18, verse 24.
You was he that wrote Hebrews?
I think that usually, if it takes 1,500 years to come up with a theory about who an author was, usually I don't even entertain it for a minute. But Martin Luther's view was that Apollos wrote Hebrews. But he makes a pretty good case. And I don't think that, you know, somebody asked me who wrote Hebrews, I say, well, the author is unknown. But I think Luther made a pretty good case for it being Apollos. And the two things I would say about it, he had to be, in my way of thinking, he had to be a colleague of Paul.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the theology is Pauline.
Right, yeah.
The grammar is not Pauline.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But the theology is. And it has, even where the theology isn't obviously Pauline, the type of argumentation is, because it's very complex, very hard to follow, and it goes off on tangents. But it's not Pauline language, terminology, vocabulary, or grammar. It's not, and it's more of an advanced Greek than Paul wrote in. It's also, it doesn't have the Pauline introduction.
Right, I think that's right.
Yeah. And then the author comes right out and admits that he was not somebody who met Jesus. Paul over and over again said, I got my gospel right from Jesus. But in Hebrews 2, 3, and 4, he said, you know, the gospel was preached from the Lord. The Lord spoke it to the apostles and others who heard him. And then God confirmed it when they told us with signs and wonders. So this is not, you know, Paul argued over and over again, like in Galatians, I'm on the same level, I got my apostleship from Jesus, not from man. And when I went and met with James and Peter, I didn't get my apostleship from them. I didn't get my gospel from them. I got it directly from Jesus. We just made sure we were on the same sheet of music, preaching the same gospel message, and then they extended the right hand of fellowship to me and Barnabas. But I got my apostleship and my gospel from Jesus. And that's not the way the author of Hebrews argues. But the author of Hebrews does mention Timothy as his brother in the Lord. So you have somebody who was in Timothy's circle writing before 70 AD, and Paul was killed in 67 AD at the latest. So I think you got a guy, Pauline, there, somebody who accompanied Paul and heard Paul's messages. And when Paul, because when we look at Paul, we're going to see that Paul first would preach the gospel message in the synagogues.
Yeah.
Even though he was the apostle to the Gentiles, he would wait until the Jews of a Gentile city in the synagogues, when they rejected the gospel message, then he said, okay, now the gospel message can be preached in the marketplaces to the,
to the
Gentiles. And, but I think that there was somebody there, wasn't Timothy, because Timothy's name is mentioned there. Somebody who was with Paul, some would argue Barnabas, some would argue Apollos, but who had been with, somebody that used to argue Luke, but the grammar is different from, although a lot of medical terms are used, but some of the grammar is different from Luke and Acts, so I don't think it's Luke. At the same time, there are some terms that are used, and some of the reasoning, some of the argumentation is very close to the argumentation of Philo, the Jewish philosopher, and who was from Alexandria. Which is basically the Alexandrian school of thought, and when you look at Apollos, you know, verse 24, Acts 18. Now, a certain Jew named Apollos, born at Alexandria.
Ah, wow.
Okay, so he's got a connection with Alexandria, an eloquent man, and mighty in the scriptures. Came, now, eloquent means that he was very versed in his speech, so. Basically, he's the kind of guy who could probably write that kind of thing. He's got the Alexandrian connection. Now, when you think what happened to the Alexandrian school eventually went down the tubes because they were so eloquent. Because they were so, you know, the world's largest library was there. Because they were so well-trained, in philosophy, and they tended to be Neoplatonists. So, you know, you had Philo, you had whatever the case, Neoplatonism can trace its roots to Plotinus, but what you have, you know, these guys real trained in Greek philosophy, trained in rhetoric and in speech and that type of thing, and so you ended up having, you know, Clement of Alexandria was a pretty good church father, but had a few weird things. And then his pupil Origen, you know, was good in some areas, but way out to lunch in some other areas. And by the time you get to his pupil, you know, the next generation Alexandrian school, we're talking Arius, the father of the Arian heresy. So, you know, but you can see where the Greek blood, now where Origen, the Alexandrian school was the first to reject premillennialism because of a hangover from Platonic thought. Why in the world would God raise a body from the dead when the invisible world of ideas is the only ultimately real thing? The physical world is less real. So a physical resurrection was...
didn't Origen also say we pre-existed?
Yeah, and that's very consistent with Plato and Socrates, because their view of the way we gain knowledge was reminiscence. It's not that we don't know things, we don't remember that we know them. Now, with those guys, it was consistent with them because they believed in reincarnation.
Yeah.
We knew them in former lives. But Origen didn't hold to that, but he wasn't beneath, you know, coming up with the idea that, okay, maybe we pre-existed as souls. But whatever the case, that whole Alexandrian school, but you read Eusebius in his Ecclesiastical History, how he slams Papias, a pupil of the apostles, up and down for thinking the vulgar idea that we would literally eat food with Jesus in the kingdom of God. And he says, obviously this man was not an educated man. You see, by the time of Eusebius, which is the time of Augustine, it was considered, the Alexandrian school had so won out that it was considered that if you were a premillennialist, you were a Neanderthal, you were a non-thinker, and because of the reputation of the Alexandrian school. But that's, you know, before all this corruption crept in, it's quite possible that Apollos, you know, still kept connections with the place of his birth, Alexandria, you know,
but he was
he may have been the forerunner of the I think the biggest evidence that he was solid is not in Acts. Acts almost says watch out for him, because Priscilla and Aquila had to take him aside because he didn't even know about the Holy Spirit.
Were they the ones that converted him?
He was already defending the Messiahship of Jesus. But he had never heard of the Holy Spirit. So this guy may have talked to Christians, studied the scriptures on his own, and came to the conclusion, yes, Jesus did fulfill the messianic prophecies, and then he went out of synagogues arguing that Jesus is the Messiah, and he must have risen from the dead, just like these guys had said. But he never even heard that there was a Holy Spirit. So obviously there was something lacking in his ministry. But when you see the way Paul talks about him, in not only is he a right-on guy, Paul refers to him as he does Apollos indirectly as an apostle.
Wow.
Now let me say this though: I believe in a two-tier apostle system, where there were the apostles appointed directly by Jesus, commissioned directly by Jesus, which would be Paul and the 12 apostles. And then apostles selected by the apostles themselves to help them in their work, their contemporaries. And I think Timothy, Barnabas, and Apollos fall in that category. It's like Paul says in, what is it, 2 Corinthians, don't I and Apollos have the same right as the other apostles to bring along a believing wife with us on our journeys and blah blah blah? And he's arguing not only that he's an apostle, he's arguing that Barnabas is also an apostle. Now, whether or not he's arguing that Barnabas is an apostle on the same level as Paul and the original apostles, I don't think that's the case.
Didn't Paul and Barnabas have an argument?
Yeah, they butt heads over John Mark. When John Mark split up one of their
missionaries. Paul was like, he's clumsy,
And then Paul said, send me John Mark, and Paul was on his getting ready to be executed because he's useful for me. So Paul learned his lesson eventually, but I think Paul was wrong.
That's a big
time.
Argument for Hebrews that Apollo would do the office. That's spectacular. Wow.
Yeah, there's quite a few things that are in there, and so we look at Apollos right now in Acts 18, verse 24. Now a certain Jew named Apollos, born at Alexandria, an eloquent man. And that word eloquent means a lot more back then. Yeah, it means a man who is eloquent in speech because of he's been trained.
Yeah.
And
like
it,
the Romans formally.
And it was like Augustine was trained. His training was in rhetoric. Today, if we say, oh, that's just a bunch of rhetoric, what we're saying is that's fancy schmancy speech, but it doesn't mean anything. That even has a throwback to the Sophist. Because the Sophist, they were the ancient Greek philosophers who were skeptics, and they believed there was no truth. So what they did was they said, well, we're so wise and we know all this stuff, we're so intelligent, but since there is really no truth, maybe truth's out there, but man can't know it, so the least we can do is make some money off of this. So the thing was, is if Carlito, if you offered me more money than Mark, I'd argue for your view. But if Mark ups it and pays me more, then I argue for his views. That's the Sophists were mercenaries. They were intellectual mercenaries. Okay? And so that's where Sophism got a bad name. But the guy who dethroned them was Socrates, where he brought absolute truth back in the picture. By the way, the Sophists led. I think we mentioned Thrasymachus. Yeah, because if morality is relative and truth is relative, then all that's left is power, and might is right. And Western culture, right on the brink of destruction, and then Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle won the day and brought moral absolutes back into the picture. And God's moral absolutes will sustain a civilization. Won't save a person, but will sustain a civilization. But like I said, today we have had our Nietzsche, our will to power guy, after the moral relativist and an epistemological relativist, but we haven't had anybody that's had the negative impact that Nietzsche's had. We haven't had a good guy with the positive impact that reaches that level, and it's kind of unfortunate. And I think we've had the guys that did the work that was needed to be done, they just went unheeded. Like C.S. Lewis, Francis Schaeffer, people like that.
Big names, but nothing really.
Well, no, they said in their writings all that needed to be said to put Nietzsche back in his coffin and show that Nietzsche's dead, not God. Unfortunately, I'm not slamming Lewis and Schaeffer. I'm slamming Western civilization for not giving them as big of a following as they should have had. Schaeffer had just the evangelicals. Outside of that, very little impact. Lewis had an influence on evangelicals, plus outside the evangelicals, some in the mainline churches, and even some skeptics. And Schaeffer had an influence on some skeptics, but we're talking,
a
very small circle of people, millions, but when you're talking in a world of billions, a few million just isn't going to do it. Whereas Nietzsche, either directly or indirectly, his thought has spread like a cancer throughout the globe, to where I think that the big question I'm looking at from the history of philosophy is, who really who influenced 20th century more than any other philosopher, and who is influencing the 21st century more than any other philosopher? Was it Nietzsche or Hegel? And I've heard guys make a case for either guy. This particular point, I side with Nietzsche, but there certainly is a Hegelian bent there where...
He was more metaphysical, wasn't he?
Yeah, and more abstract, and more... and whereas Nietzsche was more passionate.
Hegel was on the same time as Immanuel Kant, wasn't his...
After Kant, actually refuted Kant.
Oh, okay.
He basically showed that Kant said we could know reality as it appears to us, not reality as it is. Hegel's response was, well, is that statement a statement about reality as it is or not? Because if it's not, who cares? And if it is, then we can know reality as it is. And so Hegel was saying we can know reality as it is, but sense perception is just so often mistaken that Hegel became an idealist. That ideas are the real things. And so history, to a certain degree, the history of mankind and the history of philosophy are synonymous. Because history is not events, history is not people, history is ideas. The unraveling, unfolding of ideas. And so he saw like an idea, a thesis, would dominate a day, and then the antithesis, the exact opposite of it, would fight it, and eventually they'd be synthesized into another truth. Now, having said that, that's true of Hegel, but to say that's it with Hegel, everything was in these triads, thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis, that was not Hegel. That was a very obscure, I can't remember his name, German philosopher, misread Hegel as teaching the thesis, antithesis, and then the synthesis, and that everything, all of history, you can make a case that, you can see the general study, one philosopher says reality is being, and another, or reality is becoming. Change. And then another philosopher would say, no, change is an illusion. Reality is the one, the unchanging. Reality is being, not becoming. And then that gets synthesized when you get a guy like Plato comes on the scene who does justice to a certain degree to both being and becoming. And then you have Christianity coming on the scene, and Augustine synthesizes Platonism and Christianity. Aristotelian philosophy, it was Aquinas who synthesized that in Christianity. But whatever the case, Hegel was not that simplistic. In fact, in the preface to one of his works, he just came right out and said that he was opposed to the idea that history was that simple. A thesis and antithesis, and then the synthesis, which becomes a new thesis, then antithesis, and then synthesis. That sometimes you have, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 different ideas battling it out and are synthesized. So it's not just one thesis, one antithesis, and all. But whatever the case, there were these ideas being synthesized. And we've got guys today that are political leaders like Newt Gingrich. There's a guy with a PhD in history. Teaches history at some of the most prestigious universities in the country, so he's got to know about Hegel.
That's what he's doing.
He's got to know about Hegel, and he quotes from the Founding Fathers, and he cries, he weeps. He's so passionate about it. Quotes from the Founding Fathers, something they said about limited government providing freedom for us here, and Gingrich is defending some UN agenda with a quote from the Founding Fathers. Now, it's either he's the dumbest historian who ever lived, doesn't even realize how out of context he's quoting Jefferson, because Jefferson and the Founding Fathers were bad-mouthing Europe. They weren't saying, let's run back to Europe and get this big United Nations and international law. Or he sees somewhat of a synthesis. I don't know if it would be a synthesis of limited government providing freedom for its people being synthesized with the antithesis, unlimited communistic, socialistic government infringing people's rights and being synthesized as an unlimited good government giving freedom and protecting freedom and rights of all mankind. So this is what is new wave or third wave politics or whatever. It seems that it's got a very big Hegelian bent. So I don't deny that Hegel has a tremendous sense, but hey, more than half the people in the world fell under communism sometime during the 20th century, and Marx was Hegelian to a certain degree. He's not an idealist. He held to the Hegelian dialectic, but he was a materialistic, he held to the dialectic, but from a materialist standpoint. So,
Hegel didn't believe that. So,
Hegel believed Hegel's God is history. History is ideas. History is truth unfolding itself, and that we will eventually arrive. Every time we try to grasp absolute truth, it escapes us until eventually history will unfold the absolute truth, but the absolute spirit is unfolding itself through history. Hegelian dialectic is very close to the process theologians. The panentheist, where the universe is God's body, and the God is a changing God. God is becoming rather than being. They're siding with Heraclitus rather than with Plato and Aristotle.
So he doesn't believe that there is change.
No, change is the ultimate. Process is the ultimate.
History doesn't repeat itself.
Basically, change is inevitable.
That's what he's trying to say, right?
Well, he's actually... God is changed. So the Greek philosophers debated being, that which is, versus becoming, things that changing and stuff like that. Like Heraclitus said, no man steps in the same river twice. Okay, and then some of his followers said, no man steps in the same river once, because. When you put your foot down in the water, you're not even the same guy you were before you put your foot down, because there's been chemical changes within your body. And later philosophers recognized that you could have beings that become, beings that change. I think we can argue for the existence of the soul based on the fact that if you're just material, if we're just our bodies, and there's nothing else to us, then you're not the same guy you were 7 years ago. Because every cell in your body has changes every 7 years. I mean, it's not like every 7 years it's a final, complete change, but there's always our cells are always changing in our body. And 7 years from now, there will be no cell in our body that is identical with the,
how does knowledge pass? That cell that carries it is dead.
So, if that's the case, you're a totally different being than you were 7 years ago, unless something has remained the same.
Right.
And so, apart from a human soul, you're not the Carlito Schlemmer who was born 20-something years ago. Mm-hmm. And,
that changed three times.
Yeah. But with Hegel, he's going back to, in one sense, he's going back to Plato, where the emphasis of the ultimately real is in the realm of ideas, but in another sense, he's going back beyond him and saying, but everything is flux, everything is change. God is process. God is change. God is history. God is becoming. And so we're all part of it. So, you know, some would argue that we are, I am not a person who has experiences. I am my experiences. Okay? Yeah, so it the being, I, gets taken out of the picture. I'm just a set of, a list of events rather than a real being, a real person who experiences those events. There's no enduring I there. And
who's it that said, I think, therefore I am?
Descartes.
Okay. But I know he didn't mean that to think that he was... I know he was more of a Christian than anything.
I think his argument was, I exist.
And what I don't like is, like, Christian thinkers, brilliant Christian thinkers like the late Cornelius Van Til and his disciples, like the late Greg Bahnsen, and then one of Van Til's students, but not really a disciple, Francis Schaeffer. Great thinkers like Tal Brook. Misinterpret Descartes. Descartes drew a distinction between epistemology, his theory of knowledge, and his metaphysics, his theory of being, of reality. And so, if in Descartes' epistemology, the I comes first, and then God comes later. So, but they're arguing that Descartes metaphysically saying that, and he's not. So in other words, in Descartes' thinking, you know the existence of yourself first, and then from that you find the existence of God. But he's not saying God exists because I exist.
We exist because God has revealed to us we exist. Do you see something like that?
He's one
that said that we know 2 + 2 = 5. Not because of our own knowledge, but just because God revealed that to us. This table's here, not because I can feel it, but God has revealed to me that this table's real.
That's okay. Yeah. And almost all rationalists would fall in that category. Augustine.
Yeah.
What you're saying there, that's very Platonic. And in fact, I would say Augustine would argue more along those lines than even Descartes to a certain degree. Although Descartes did argue a lot from the axioms of geometry, But basically, Descartes was looking for something that he could doubt. He wanted to doubt everything as a method until he could find something he couldn't doubt. So the more he doubted, the more he acknowledged the existence of the doubter. So he said, I think, I doubt, doubt is a form of thinking, I think, therefore I am.
That's right. He also said that everything else is false until God reveals it to us. I think I'm very sure I read that couple. I read them like a few weeks ago. I don't know,
and if he said something like that, I'd like to see, read the context,
see
what exactly he meant. Because I could see Descartes saying, I will consider everything false unless God reveals it to me with certainty.
Because
he was looking for like like the axioms of geometry, something that you knew with absolute certainty, and then he could deduce all others from. But because his argument led to his existence first, and then from there to God's existence. He wasn't saying that God's existence was dependent upon his.
Right.
But there are Christian thinkers, brilliant Christian thinkers, man, that slam him for that. But Van Til had the idea that if you argue from anything, if your first premise does not already contain God, it's idolatry. So in Van Til's thought, but there are a lot of guys who really aren't Van Tilian anymore. They're not really Van Tilian in their thought, but they've been influenced by guys who've been influenced by him. So they use that same argument against Descartes, and they don't realize that A, Descartes never really reasoned that way, and B, the only time you can make any sense out of a slam on Descartes like that is from a Van Tilian worldview.
which very few people hold to a Van Tillian worldview. But I thought that too. I thought that was blasphemous. I think, therefore, I am. But, you know, it's just like, well, it's probably like Van Til was probably thinking too.
Oh, yeah, not God in there. Yeah, Van Tillian just saw Aquinas arguing from the creation to God as being blasphemous. See, it looks like we won't have time for today. I was planning on talking about truth and knowledge, how we know the truth.